They abandoned their belief in the supernatural. Now you are asking me to sabotage that achievement, to send them back into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance and fear? No!
And hello everyone, welcome to Trolling World Logic. It's the 4th of August 2013, it's 6 p.m. in the UK, 1 p.m. Eastern Time in the States. Welcome everyone this Sunday to our show, as usual, a weekly podcast on science, secularism, skepticism, philosophy, all that kind of good stuff. Just a few notes, if you can call in at any time if you want to join in the conversation, you just add in the Skype contact Trolling World Logic, and just send me a PM first with a just to your question, and we'll add you on it in time. Please don't call the show, it just kind of disrupts and kind of distracts us while we're in. Send a PM first and I'll add you in. Also, bear in mind, we are recording and broadcasting live, so if you call in, you grant us permission to use your likeness, so no funny stuff with the DMCAs. Also, if you can't get through, you can't ask a question, any other general questions, contact at throwingwithlogic.com is our email. We'll be happy to reply to them, or if it's a question for a guest, we can always pass it on to them. Just a quick announcement, next week's advertised show with Phil Moriarty, so that's been postponed yet again. Phil's had some personal issues come up. We will get him on again at a future date. And I think that's the one more announcement. As Throwing Logic, we are looking for new panelists to take on, so if you're out there listening in podcast land and you think you could do this, please send us an email and we'll hit you up on Skype and see if you're a good fit for the show. So all we need is just people who can commit to every other Sunday or so, just being able to do the show, interview some interesting people. And talking of interesting people, that kind of segues nicely into our guest. Welcoming our special guest today, the Regius Professor of Astronomy at Edinburgh University. Please, everybody, welcome Professor Andy Lawrence. Hi, Andy.
Hello, nice to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on. If I remember right from our emails, you have something pre-prepared for us to kick us off.
Yeah, I've got a little sort of a list of philosophical bugs connected with astronomy that I'd be very interested to hear people's reactions to, and hopefully we'll start some discussion.
Okay.
Do you want to go straight in with that, or do you want you're doing some more intro first? I just follow your guidance.
All right. Sorry, I didn't introduce my co-host today. Sorry, Marty, we left you out there. Welcoming, as always, Martimer, welcome.
Hello.
Yeah, how you doing, Marty?
Well, I'm doing fine.
All right. So I think we'll just go into what Andy had pre-prepared. So fire away, Andy, and we'll kind of kick the discussion off from there.
Okay. So let me just start with a brief apology, because I was meant to be on 2 weeks ago and had some issues. So my apologies for messing that up. A little later on, I'm happy to answer questions on anything to do with astronomy, space science, science politics, more or less anything really. Yeah. But what I wanted to do at the beginning was talk about some things that bug me, that I'd be particularly interested to hear what your panel, your listeners think about these issues. I think it's particularly interesting to hear what dedicated skeptics and atheists think on the issues I'm going to bring up. So it'll become clear in a moment, I hope. So I'm just going to start by saying a little bit about myself, a little bit about the science that I do, and then I'm going to describe the things that bug me. Okay?
Yep.
Am I sounding clear, by the way?
Crystal clear.
Okay, so myself. So I'm a professional astronomer. I work at the University of Edinburgh, as you mentioned. So that means what I do with my life is I do research, I teach, and of course I do lots of administration and politics. Overall, it's a pretty cool job. It's hard work, but I'm very pleased with my job. I feel I'm a kind of lucky guy to be doing such a cool job. Scientifically, what I do mostly, over most of my career, I've been particularly interested in quasars and active galaxies and the black holes that we think power them. I've also worked on starburst galaxies, a little bit of cosmology. But also over my whole career, I've worked on big surveys, maps of the sky. And that's led me into astronomical information technology, an idea called the virtual observatory that we could talk about later if anybody wants to. So that's what I do, what my science is about. Now, it's a pretty techie job. We can all appreciate, love, and use science. And like most scientists, I feel strongly that the more the general public and policymakers and so on understand science and apply a scientific approach to life, you know, the better society would be. But that's all about the use and appreciation of science. To actually be a professional researcher, to discover new facts about the universe and take it forward, it's much more technical. You need a lot of training. You need physics. You need maths. You need a cool logic. To some extent, you need to be able to detach from your subject matter. And then that's because, you know, it's easy to be fooled by so-called common sense. If you can see me now, I'm kind of doing quote marks with my fingers around the common sense. You know, common sense is really just accumulated prejudice. And so this is what makes understanding the natural world so hard. You need to very patiently gather the facts. You need to do the maths. And more than anything else, you need to be prepared to be wrong, to realize you're wrong, to change your mind, and so on. So it's a pretty technical job, and it has a very specific kind of procedural basis. Okay, so that's all about the kind of technical side of being an astronomer or being any sort of scientist, really. I'm also a normal human being. You know, I have kids, I have a mortgage, my car goes wrong. I have all the usual stuff, all the usual pleasures and pain. So I am a scientist, which is pretty unusual, but I'm also a regular human being. So what I'm interested in, getting to the point, is how we should react as human beings. So not just as scientists, as technically trained people, but as human beings to the weird and wonderful discoveries that we make in astronomy. So, for example, does it make a difference what we've discovered about the universe? Does it make a difference to whether I feel I should be an atheist or a Christian or a Zen Buddhist or what? Does it make a difference to whether I should be a skeptic or a mystic, a relativist or an essentialist? Does it make any difference to my daily life, how I should go about living my life? So I'm always interested, and when I give popular talks, I love to ask people these questions because the range of answers is quite broad. So I'm going to just going to give you a few examples, and then I'll shut up and see if anybody else has any feelings about this. So I'm going to divide this into three parts. I'm going to talk about insignificant. I'm going to talk about beauty and meaning, and thirdly, whether or not we are alone. Okay, so let's take the first one of those, insignificance. So I think most people know that the universe is a pretty big place. It is really very, very big. So as Douglas Adams famously said in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you may think it's a long way to the chemist, but the universe is really, really big. It's incredibly big. It's very hard to grasp, and we can write down lots of zeros. The classic way we do this, if we're trying to give popular talks or teach students, is to do it in steps. So, you know, you can say that the sun is 100 times bigger than the Earth, that the distance to the nearest star is about 7,000 times more than the distance to Pluto. And you can go through steps like that, but after a few of those steps, it's you're still already getting dizzy. It's a huge number. It's very hard to take in. Now, that's quite well known, I think. Perhaps not so well known is that the universe, or the things in the universe, are also unbelievably violent. The amount of power coming out of astronomical objects is very hard to get your head around. And even the sun, let alone, you know, my favorite sun, powerful quasars and so on. So, you know, we think an atomic bomb is pretty impressive, you know, a huge bang. But the power coming out of the sun is something like 10 billion atomic bombs going off every second. And that's just the sun. It's just very hard to get your head around. Thirdly, and perhaps worst, you know, we're not in the center of anything. We're just kind of boringly typical. We've been fooled twice because, you know, in history we used to think we were the center of the solar system, and then we thought we were the center of the Milky Way, but we're not. We're just in some random place. So we're lost in space, and we're in some kind of boring suburb somewhere. If I talk about this in Edinburgh, I typically say it's like being in Oxgangs, and then people who live in Oxgangs get cross with me. But anyway, how do we react to this? Do we feel that we're proud to be inside this vast and wonderful universe, and therefore we go about our life happier? Or do we just feel feeble, lost, puny, pointless, and that makes things, makes it harder to carry on? So that, just hold that thought, and we'll just, the two other examples now. So beauty and meaning. I'm going to contrast two typical astronomical pictures. So the first one, if you can imagine it, is a picture of a random star field. And it's mostly black, but scattered all over it, there are little points of light, which are, of course, distant stars. And the harder you look, or the deeper the picture is, the more of these tiny faint dots you see. But still, most of the picture is black, and they're just endless huge numbers of these stars. Now, looking at a picture like that, it's a very typical reaction to bring on a sort of existentialist nausea. You just feel, well, this, you stare at this and you just know that there's no meaning or purpose to anything. There's just endless stuff. And it's almost as if you can feel the wind blowing through your head. Right? It's just, as I say, this existentialist kind of emptiness. Right, so that's picture number one. Picture number two, imagine a picture of the Trifid Nebula or some beautiful spiral galaxy, or perhaps, you know, the Orion Nebula or something like that. A lot of astronomical pictures, the sort of thing that's in all the coffee table books. You see structure, you see colors, you see patterns, and they're just very beautiful. People love these pictures. So a typical reaction looking at things like this is to feel a sense of beauty, a sense of awe, of wonderment, and very often people are moved by such pictures. So then a contrasting image to the previous existentialist nausea stuff, sometimes when people look at these pictures, there's a feeling that it's not, it kind of can't be a coincidence that it moves us so much. And a lot of people think, well, now I've got some kind of connection with this. Okay, now at one extreme, it can encourage people's religious feelings and, you know, the face of God and all that sort of thing. But it, even without going that far, it can encourage a kind of more general sort of mystical feeling, some kind of feeling of connection. So which of those two is a correct reaction to the universe as a human being? The existentialist nausea or the feeling of beauty and connection? All right, final thing. So is there life elsewhere, and what difference does this make? So far, the thing we know is that nobody's come to visit us. I mean, despite what some UFO seekers believe, of course, no, nobody's come. And so far, we haven't found any life elsewhere. We haven't found life on Mars. We tried very hard, but we didn't. We're thinking maybe there might be some primitive life under the ice on Europa, but we don't know yet, and it's unlikely to be anything other than extremely primitive. But it's still worth carrying on looking. And, of course, the fashionable thing now is to look further out into the universe. And you may have heard of the Drake equation, this calculation of how much intelligent life there should be in the universe. First of all, you say, how many stars have planets? What fraction of stars have got planets around them? And of those planets, which, how many of them are capable of supporting life? And of that fraction, what fraction actually did begin life? And of that life that formed, what fraction of it developed into intelligent life? How long does that life last? Do civilizations blow up after 1,000 years, or do they go on for millions of years, etc.? So the Drake equation's been around for a long time. So one of the most exciting things over the last 10 or 20 years is the first step of that equation has finally become a real scientific topic, not just a kind of pub discussion topic. So we know now that there are planets around other stars. We've got ways of finding them, and we know of hundreds of planets. It's very normal to have planets around other stars. So there's a long way to go, but we're creeping along. Now, of course, the other thing people have done for a while is to actively search for extraterrestrial intelligence. You've probably heard of the SETI project. Yeah. It's a very long shot, very unlikely to turn anything up, but you know, some people think for that reason it's pointless, and others feel, you know, we've got to keep doing it. The question I'm interested in here, from the human point of view again, is this just a scientific issue we'd like to know, or is it really a cultural and religious one? So, for instance, one obvious thing is that if we did find life elsewhere, it might be kind of hard to justify the notion that we are God's special people. Now, I know most of the people who tune in to Trolling with Logic will think that's kind of obvious anyway, from contrasting different societies on the Earth, of course. But it might become more normal, it might have a profound impact, and it might become more normal for everybody to think that. So is that true, or does it really not make much difference to those basic questions? So should we carry on looking against the odds, or should we not? And does it make a difference? So just briefly, and I recommend you check this out for a bit of amusement at the end. I don't know how many of you have seen this, the thing called WETI, which stands for Waiting for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They have a Twitter account, and a website. It's wonderful. It's a joke basically, but it's kind of making a point as well. Their mission statement says that, you know, they're addressing one of the most profound questions in the history of science and humanity by waiting to see what happens, and that this is much cheaper than building fast arrays of radio telescopes, etc. And the Twitter account is wonderful. I follow it, and once every day or two you see a tweet from Wetty which says, "Oh, hang on, I think, oh no, nothing." And it just goes on day after day. So it's very funny, but there is a big point behind it. Right, so at the end of that, I don't know whether I've depressed or fascinated you or whether it's all obvious anyway, but at this point I'll shut up and see if anybody else has an opinion on some of those questions.
I suppose, I think Martimush had to disappear again, so I'll give my kind of quick opinion, like how I've always felt about astronomy. While, you know, I find the Hubble pictures incredible, you know, they're breathtaking and inspirational, but on the other side, it's when you venture the vast numbers, just the fact we can't actually go there and see it for ourselves up close. I mean, it's kind of a balance between the two. On one side, it's inspirational, but then knowing that we can't really get out there to see it.
Does that vastness and the difficult, the fact that you can't get out there,
yeah,
does it depress you, or is that just cool?
Kind of a disappointment. It's almost like getting the holiday brochure and looking in your bank account and just knowing there's no way I'll ever afford that holiday. You know, it's that kind of feeling. You know, but you can still look at the pictures and appreciate it on some level, which is, well, it's not completely depressing to me. It's just a bit, oh, no, we can't really just get out there to these and see these galaxies and nebulas right up close and find out all about them.
Oh, that's quite interesting. So you look at it and you think, oh, that's wonderful, I'd love to go there.
Yeah, but we can't, and that's the bummer.
Sometimes that would be a big mistake. So pictures of Venus look very, very beautiful.
Yep.
It looks a very, very nice place. But the surface of Venus is extremely unpleasant. It's 700 degrees, many atmospheric pressures, and sulfuric acid in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
You know, it's... I wouldn't like to be there.
or at the very least get close enough, you know, to have a look at them, you know, up close rather than actually interact with them. At the very least, you know, that's kind of a little bit frustrating for that. You know, there's just, you know, it's relativity, isn't it? That's just preventing us from actually getting out there to a lot of these places, because the journeys would just be so incredibly long.
But also just very expensive. I think if you can get up to relativistic speed, then from the point of view of the traveller, it's not as long as you think. A lot more time will have passed for in the Earth, so you can't go home, as it were.
It's a one-way ticket, yeah.
Yeah, but it's still, but to get to that sort of velocity, to make that plausible, is a huge amount of energy, so it would cost a lot of money. I did this calculation once, but I can't remember it. So, I mean, to take you know, a few thousand people to the nearest star on a reasonable time scale, it's not that it just costs a $1 billion or whatever. It costs like the whole world economy for 500 years or something. It was incredible. Yeah. So you'd have to really decide as a society that this is what you had to do and devote a large fraction of your output to doing it.
Okay, I just seen a question crop up in the chat room. It's just when you mentioned Venus there, they're asking, could it ever be plausible to terraform Venus? That's from Organic Beekeeper.
Oh, well, yes, I'm not quite the right person to ask that. I think it would be extremely hard, because it's not just a question of transforming the surface. You'd have to completely change the atmosphere. I'm sorry, I'm not really an expert on that, but my instinct was it would be extremely hard.
Yeah. I mean, terraforming in general, is that feasible? Like, does it just, like, say Mars, for example, is that feasible in any way?
Well, my understanding is that it would be considerably easier for Mars, because it's closer to a twin for the Earth. It has some water. It has a thin atmosphere. You know, you can do something.
Yeah.
But again, I think actually it's a little bit like the issue of doing interstellar travel.
Right.
It's just an incredibly ambitious thing to do.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's not like building a big bridge. It would be so hard to do. You know, you wouldn't even think about it until we got the world government and you know, we can all spend a large fraction of our effort doing it.
Yeah.
So I think it's politically impractical. It really is my instinct, although and my guess is that it's physically plausible for Mars and not for Venus, but I might be wrong there, so be careful with my reaction to that.
Okay. Mortimer, we can bring you in again now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It sounded like it was going to be a really interesting thing to talk about here, all the stuff that you started talking about, and I had to run off.
It's no problem. We can go back to the stuff at the beginning if you want, Marty. So.
Yeah, I don't know how much time you spent on it, and if it's worth going over again, I don't know.
Well, for Marty, could you give a really quick rundown, Andy, of what the main points were?
Okay. So what I was basically talking about was how we should react as human beings to the amazing discovery in astronomy, as opposed to scientists or technicians. And I took kind of three examples. One about how the universe is incredibly big, it's incredibly powerful, and that we're not in the center of things, we're extremely puny and insignificant. And so the question I posed is, does that make us feel proud to be inside this vast and wonderful universe and we go about life happier? Or does it make us feel kind of lost and feeble and pointless and it's harder to carry on? How do we react to that immensity?
If I could just take them one at a time, I'll try to give quick answers as I feel. I just find the vastness of the universe fascinating. It makes me curious. It makes me want to know more about it. And the more I learn about it, the more amazing it seems to become. So that's basically my reaction to that. The idea of feeling insignificant just doesn't really occur to me. I mean, I am what I am.
Well, I think that's a very grown-up reaction, I think. You know, I would hope that that's gradually a reaction of more and more people, but it's not always the reaction.
No, definitely not.
So that's connected to the second one, which I think is particularly appropriate for a sort of skeptical atheist sort of activity. So I contrasted two pictures, a kind of star field with lots of blackness and little dots. And a lot of people look at this. It's connected to the insignificance thing again. But basically, when you look at that, it brings on your existentialist nausea. You feel that, you know, it convinces you there's no meaning or purpose to anything. There's just endless stuff. On the other hand, a lot of astronomical pictures are very beautiful, you know, nebulae, spiral galaxies, and so on. And people often sort of react to that by feeling a sense of awe and wonderment. And this is when people get kind of sort of pub religious, if you saw what I mean, and talk about a sense of connection and so on. Now, of course, I have to say that being cautious of or worrying about the effect of traditional organized religion is not necessarily an argument against a more general mystical or pantheist feeling, such as Einstein was famous for instance. Yeah. So there's a good philosophical question, but still, then this one for scientists I know is quite diverse. So basically, whether it brings on your existentialist nausea, or whether it, let's say that's putting it a bit prejudicially, that it makes you feel there is no meaning or purpose, or whether it makes you feel, oh, it's not a coincidence that I'm impressed by this, and there's some kind of connection and it makes sense.
I guess I feel somewhere in the middle there, because I obviously don't believe that there's an intent behind all of it, but I recognize that feeling of being part of it and all that stuff, because that's something I talked about on the show at one point. Someone brought up the subject of spirituality, and I explained that probably one of the most, I think what people mean when they talk about a spiritual or religious experience, one that I can remember having myself is the first time I pointed a telescope at Jupiter. So,
yes.
It wasn't the first time. I think I did it when I was a kid, and I borrowed my uncle's telescope. And then it was just, well, it's Jupiter, big deal. But then the next time, the one I really remember is when I was actually taking an astronomy class in college. And then it meant something, because then I knew what I was looking at in a completely different way.
Yes, yes.
So I guess I don't feel that it's all pointless. I guess. I mean, I don't see. That's not phrasing it properly. It is pointless, but that doesn't make it pointless, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you mean, so there isn't an external point, there isn't, for instance, you know, a god or a prophet who explains it all to you, so there's no externally given point, but it doesn't make you feel pointless.
Exactly.
So the third thing was looking for life elsewhere. And whether it's important to do so, again, whether that's simply a scientific question, and it's one that's making a little bit of progress, or whether it's important because it's a cultural and religious question, and it will make a difference to how the mass of humanity feel about life in the universe, whether there's life elsewhere, especially whether there's intelligent life elsewhere. Should we look, or is it a waste of money and time because it's an extremely long shot? Looking for signals, for instance, as SETI does, is extremely unlikely to work, and it's not sure what we'll learn scientifically if we do. So maybe it's just a silly thing to do, or maybe it's a crucial thing to do because it's the most important thing that could happen to our society and mess with our brains.
Yeah, that's a tough one, actually, because, I mean, while I'm very interested in the question, I mean, I would like to know if there's life out there, but indeed, what difference does it make? What do we learn? I mean, it's just, okay, we would learn that there's life out there. Yay. That's a tough one. I mean, I definitely think it's worth looking.
Yes, that's would you spend as much money as we do on the Large Hadron Collider or the biggest new telescope or whatever, or is it just an interesting sideline?
I think it would be hard to justify spending that much money on it because there's more important things to do. People can always compare it with, how much money we spend trying to cure cancer. That's an obvious one.
Yes.
So I kind of like the idea they had with letting amateur astronomers look for it. I don't remember what it was they did.
Oh, that's the SETI Online project.
Yeah.
So what they're doing there, that doesn't add any search facilities, doesn't add lots more radio telescopes, but the signals that the SETI astronomers get, it's just a lot of data. It's pretty hard to look through it all and decide whether any of the signals show patterns that might be an indication of intelligent life. So the idea was it's kind of crowdsourcing the processing power. So people who signed up to SETI Online, and there were very large numbers of them, would be sent little packets of data and they'd install software on their computers, so everybody do a little bit of the processing and look to see if there's any patterns. And then return the answer. So basically, it was kind of a cheap way of getting a sort of supercomputer distributed across the globe by using lots of spare CPU cycles. And there have been other similar projects since, but that was the first one. And as you probably know, there are now the so-called citizen science projects, which I think are really deeply wonderful, where rather than using people's spare CPU cycles, and keen individuals actually do some of the science. So this started with a thing called Galaxy Zoo, which I think involves hundreds of thousands of people. It's quite incredible. You can log onto that website, you can get trained in how to classify pictures of galaxies, and then it throws up lots of pictures of galaxies one after the other, and you put them into boxes, as it were, or look for strange things. It's like having hundreds of thousands of PhD students at your sort of control to, and so that's been very powerful. But the SETI Online thing was basically about CPU cycles.
Yeah, but it's still a way to cut back on the cost.
It's true that if they'd have done that much processing themselves, then they would have had to have bought a supercomputer that would have cost them 50 million quid or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Martin, can you read that question? Because I'm not sure how to pronounce the name of the star thing that this guy's on about.
How soon will we be able to observe the Perseid shower?
Perseid.
Oh, Perseid, yeah. I was just too nervous about mispronouncing it, sorry. Yeah, you're saying, how soon will we be able to observe the Perseid shower this month? The maximum activity's on the 12th, he's saying?
Yes, that sounds about right. So just to explain to others, so the Perseid, it's a meteor shower. You get yourself to a nice dark sky and stare at the sky, and you see shooting stars. And now you can see shooting stars any night of the year from a good dark site. So the thing about, there's a few showers every month when there's just a lot more. And the Perseids, which is always in August, is the most predictably good meteor shower. When there'll be many more meteors per hour than during the rest of the year. So
it's because the Earth's orbit is crossing some belt or something, right? Or
it was like a little sort of dust trail. So basically, the meteor showers come from comets that have passed through the solar system before, and they've left behind little kind of streaks of dust, little tiny little particles. Dust is about the right kind of size. Like little grains of sand. Some are as big as peas, but they're pretty small bits of rock basically. And so after the comet's gone, it's left behind this trail of debris. And then yes, every so often the Earth's orbit passes through one of these trails of debris. So there's little bits of rock up there all the time, which is why we see shooting stars all the time. When we'll be able to observe it, it's a bit hard to answer that because it depends how patient you are. I think I've seen some tweets from keener people who say they've been seeing some already. But basically the rate will gradually increase up to that maximum. When you're at the maximum in the Perseids, you can go outside, and as long as you're in a dark sky, if you stare up at the sky within a minute or two, you'll see something. And if you stand out there for an hour, you'll see lots. Nice. So as it's building up, you might have to stand out there for 10 minutes before you see one, right?
But you can see this anywhere on the planet, or is it just in specific locations?
I should know the answer to that question. It's got to be night time, right? So it's different times of day. Pretty much anywhere. I think You do need to be in the northern hemisphere because you'll see some from anywhere, but you'll. The reason they're called the Perseids is that they seem on average as if they're radiating from a point in the constellation of Perseus. And that's just to do with the direction of this streak of dust that we're passing through at the time. You see more in one direction than another. So that does mean that it's optimum. For the Perseids in the northern hemisphere, but quite a large fraction of the sky. So, and anybody getting back to the kind of mystical thing. So, and I think you mentioned Marty earlier on about seeing Jupiter through a small telescope, and I love showing people Jupiter or Saturn through small telescopes because they makes people suddenly realize that it's not just something on the internet or, you know, on TV or in a book. It's actually real.
Exactly.
They, you know, their eyeball is looking through, and this is why it's good to actually look through an eyepiece rather than have it, you know, projected onto a CCD camera. Because you look with your own eye and yeah. you can see it, and it hits you suddenly. It's real. And then you step back and you look up at the sky, and then you look again and you think it's there, and you know, you can point at it, and it feels very concrete and real, and it's a very striking human feeling. Shooting stars are like that. Now, this used to be completely normal, of course, for a large fraction of humanity, and well, elsewhere in the world it still is, but in Europe or the USA it's much less common because we all live in cities. We very rarely see dark skies, so we're not used to the idea. So it used to be that anybody, you know, walking home at the end of their working day, or you know, on the way to the pub or whatever, you would see shooting stars. It was completely normal. But now most people don't. So if you go on holiday to the Canaries or something, or somewhere in the south of France, and suddenly there's some dark sky, or if you're lucky with the weather, on the Isle of Lewis, perfect. And you know, as we know, there are other factors there, i.e. the clouds. But the north of Scotland is pretty amazing too. So yeah, if you manage to get outside and you see shooting stars, again, if you just make yourself think, you know, there is a little grit of sand that has just streaked through the atmosphere. You know, it started in space and it's landed here. Well, it hasn't landed because it's burnt up, but you know, it's quite a profound feeling, that, you know, it's very kind of real. It's very easy to do. Anybody can do it. You don't even need binoculars. You just get yourself to a dark sky. And I say that in a nice dark sky. The other thing that's comparable to this that I recommend to anybody is to simply see the Milky Way, which again, for most people, in traditional, Britain used to be normal, and now it's very rare. But you get yourself to a dark place and, and see the Milky Way. And then you see that the Milky Way is a kind of strip across the sky and goes diagonally across the sky. And then when you think, well, why is it a kind of band across the sky? It's because we live in a flattened disk of stars, right? So if you're looking up out of the disk, you see relatively few stars. If you're looking through the disk, through its thickness, you see lots and lots of distant faint stars blurred together. And then as you look round in a circle, anywhere in a kind of circle around the sky, you're looking through the disk. So that's what happens. And so it's very beautiful, but also, it's, again, it's one of those kind of real concrete feelings. You see the Milky Way, and it can just suddenly hit you. This is what I live inside. I live inside a disk of stars. And you can also see, the nearest other galaxy, M31, the Andromeda Nebula. You can see with the naked eye. Again, you need to be in a dark place, but you can see that. And then there's another one of these, outside our own. So I've kind of rabbited on a bit there and waxed lyrical. But the answer is how soon you can see the Perseid shower depends on how patient you are. And I believe some people are seeing some now, but over the next few days it should become gradually easier. And for most people, you need to be within a day or two for it to be really easy and striking. But it depends how dark your sky is and how patient you are.
Marty, do you have any questions there?
No, not right now.
There was a question. It's one I had since we had you confirmed as a guest, and it's just a general one. Like, what's the kind of most annoying kind of bogus claim that you've had to deal with that seems to crop up a lot, like directed at astronomers? Like, I think in every science, like, there's always something that they're always having, you know, that's something that's been really badly misreported that you're always having to kind of respond to and clarify. Is there something like that that always kind of seems to follow you around?
Well, I'll give you two extreme versions. One is the did we land on the moon thing.
So I don't
get that one too much personally myself, but everybody gets it every so often. And you know, there are just depressingly large numbers of people who take this seriously. There's a guy in Glasgow, who you might consider having on sometime. I think that's Martin Hendry, who has a little talk. He got so fed up with this that he made a little talk, which he tours around as a public talk, going through all the arguments about, you know, whether the flag's waving, what direction the light is, and all that stuff. And he goes through all these things and demolishes them one by one. It's a very nice talk. But sometimes I think there's hardly any point bothering, because there's always going to be some people who insist, It's very hard to talk them round.
The problem with conspiracy theorists is that they love to believe the conspiracy so much that they just, it's like religion. They're not going to change their mind no matter what.
Yes, there are some people who say that Fred Hoyle was like that about the steady state universe, of course, but we'll pass over that. That's the kind of most annoying one, because it's so widespread and so insulting to the very brave people who went there and so on. There's all sorts of minor things which crop up in science fiction movies and so on, but you just do your best in trying to get in there. But I thought I'd mention something at the opposite extreme that is currently annoying a number of very professional cosmologists. Because it's not just a popular misconception. A large fraction of other astronomers get this wrong, and it's an error that's been embedded even into the astronomy textbooks for a long time, and it's to do with whether or not space is expanding. And you see some quite, as well as, you know, sort of low-level textbooks and so on, you see a lot of sort of popular videos and all sorts of things that explain that the universe isn't really expanding, it's that space is expanding, and the cosmological redshift is due to the expansion of space itself. And this confuses the hell out of people. For instance, so, you know, people always ask, quite correctly, well, am I expanding then? You know, and is Stornoway getting further away from it than from Edinburgh all the time? No, it's not, see, because there are forces holding things together, so the solar system's not expanding. And you ask, well, okay, is the Milky Way expanding? You know, where is this? Why is it just the galaxies? Is it? And so a lot of astronomers teach us in their courses, and if they're not working cosmologists themselves, they get very confused about this. So the professional line at the moment is that space does not expand. There's something peculiar in the history of the universe, which means that matter set off in an expansionary mode. And why that happened, what the initial conditions were, and how it's evolving with time is a very deep and difficult question. But space itself is not actually expanding, and it makes no sense to think of space itself expanding. Things are moving through space. Space itself is a slightly difficult concept in general relativity, and it's not just a kind of passive arena as it is in Newtonian physics, but it's not correct to think of space itself expanding. So I've been involving a few kind of astronomer blog debates on this very issue over the last few days, and people get quite irate about this. So you may find, I'd be interested to hear what Sean Carroll would have said, who had on a short while ago. But I know a number of cosmologists who get very hot under the collar about that issue.
Okay, we do have a caller there. Jay, can you hear us?
Yes, clear.
Okay, you're on with Andy, so ask your question.
Good evening, everyone.
Hello.
My question is, a lot of people say astronomy and other science, it's try to find new life away from Earth. It is take a lot of money from taxes and everything, and the real issue in this Earth. So how you can respond to them?
Well, let me take that's a very good question. Let me take it in two parts. One is how much money we should spend on astronomy in general, and then within astronomy, you know, whether we should spend it, as we were talking earlier, on looking for life elsewhere, or whether we should spend it trying to understand stars and galaxies and quasars. So taking that second one first, my answer to people would be, actually, within the science budget, the amount that gets spent on looking for life elsewhere is very, very tiny. It's not mostly what happens, and in fact, there less than 0.1% of the astronomy budget goes on that kind of work. And in fact, there are a number of people who think we should spend considerably more. So that's true for the astronomy budget. Now, should we be having radio telescopes that look for signals and so on? But it's also true even in the kind of planetary exploration budget. Most of NASA's budget is not spent on sending something to Europa. And again, it's part of the Mars rover thing, of course, is still looking for signs of life, but it's quite a small part of the NASA budget. So now, whether I do all the time, of course, it get questions about whether we should be spending money on astronomy at all, as opposed to building hospitals, building roads, education, how much of our taxes should go on it. So the way I generally deal with that. Let me just say, first of all, is that I'm actually glad that I'm not a minister, I'm not a politician, because deciding the right amount of money to spend on these things is incredibly difficult. So, it's very, very hard. If people are skeptical about how much money is being spent, I generally try to get them to guess how much out of your tax money goes on astronomy. So I can try that with you if you like. Because I did just work this out the other day. So we're all paying our taxes and the government collects it. So I'm talking about the UK now, okay?
Okay.
So suppose you've got £100 worth of tax money. How much of that should be spent on astronomy? Obviously, most of that money should go on roads, hospitals, etc. How much money out of £100 should be spent on astronomy? What do you think?
Martin, Jay, you go first.
Yeah, thank you. For me, I think it is the issue about the space and the money on the space. It is not going just gone with the wind. When you see in reality, every single machines and even small things make different in a space area research. Yep. That give the Earth and the humanity here a lot of benefit, because they use that technology here in the Earth.
Yes.
Even in the medical, and even in a lot of things.
It is not
just for space. When you spend this money and the government spend this money, it is spent for kind of science. It is good for futures. It is not just for today. I think we should spend general in science much more than already done, because the budget is not so high in many countries.
Let me just say that at some level the government do understand exactly the argument you've made, and the fact that we have lots of money, especially in space, is precisely because they know, although they may give the money to scientists and engineers, it ends up going back. We spend it in high technology companies to build our toys and run things, and so it all goes back to Astrium and Arianespace and so on. So to some extent, governments do understand this argument, that the money they give us is about feeding high technology industry, which has to be good in general. And I think if it wasn't for that, so you're very strongly correct, I think, and if it wasn't for that, we would get much, much less money. But still, nobody's guessed yet how much we do spend. No.
How much we do spend? I'm gonna say 50p and £100.
Okay.
Marty,
any advance?
Marty.
2%. 2%.
2%. That would be £2. Marty, do you have a guess?
I have no idea, but it is not a lot.
Yeah, well, I think I think Marty wins. The answer is about 3.5p.
Oh, jeez.
Right. Yeah. So the astronomy budget. So in absolute terms, when I tell you the number, it's a big number. We spend about £200 million every year. So it's that's the budget of the Science and Technology Facilities Council. So it's probably a little
Which
bit more
country?
In
pay.
So that's UK. Sorry, that's okay. United Kingdom. So per head, the USA is considerably more, but not wildly more. The amount is probably quite similar in France, Germany, etc. But we in the United Kingdom, we spend about £200 million per year on astronomy. So as a sum of money, it's enormous, you know. And many people I know who they're in theatre or whatever, and they're sort of struggling, and they could do with some of that. It'd be lovely. So it's a lot of money, and we should be very careful about making sure that we are good value for the taxpayer. It's a serious amount of money. But the tax revenue of the United Kingdom is about £550 billion. So that's about one out of every 2,500. So that's how I arrived at about 3.5p.
By the way, a friend of mine's invent me next week to go and show with them that the showers of the stars will happen. And I think it will be an incredible experiment for me. What do you think?
Oh, yes, I recommend for anybody to do that. So where do you live, Jay?
Unfortunately, I cannot say where I am live because I am an atheist and I'm under threat of death.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah, fine.
But
yes.
I wish if I can go this event because will be for me a new one. And really, I am really excited about that. So wish me if I can go, really. Can I say, go ahead.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I want to ask Zolo if I can go. Next question or not?
One more question, Jay. We do have another caller lined up. So,
okay. Yeah. Anyway, I should go because here the situation is not good. The other question is about religion people and what they are in space and the new life. How you can approach the religion people and tell them, look, people, your holy books in any religion say like this, like that, but the reality is there, it is this. What the method you use to make that clear for them?
That's a very interesting and difficult question, and it's a very different problem in different parts of the world, I feel, in the UK or the USA. Many other parts of the world, I think the answer would be quite different. I mean, my instinct is that confrontation too quickly is not profitable because the religious instinct is so strong and the existing social structures are so powerful and entrenched, both politically, socially, and in people's minds, that it's not just going to disappear quickly. It just won't. So I think you've got to kind of sneak logical and humanist thinking in gradually. So you don't try and tell people they're wrong. You just try and tell them about the universe and how things work. And if they want to, say, well, that can't be right, then you may start to have a debate with them. And as we know, easier in some circumstances than others. But I think my instinct is always not to start that way, but to just do everything positive and tell people about how the universe, both the natural world and the cosmic universe and the biological universe, evolution, everything. Just quietly say how life works and how wonderful it is, and just keep plugging away at that question. Because I think, because you know, religion's not going to go away very quickly. I think, and crudely speaking, the hope is that it will atrophy. And this is why the USA is particularly puzzling to Europeans, because I think, you know, in the UK we're used to the idea that that is precisely what's kind of happening, but gradually with time, religion becomes less and less interesting to people, because we're not frightened, and we've learned how the universe works, and we're, the social structures that used to support it are gradually disappearing, and that all that gradually decay. But you know, in most ways, the USA and the UK are very, very similar, but as we know, religion's big issue in the USA. People take it very seriously. So I think that means that as a British scientist, I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because we simply don't have to face this problem in quite the same way that that other people do. We are. I think even on the Isle of Lewis, there may be shops open on a Sunday now.
Yes, there are. There's one shop, and all the pubs are open, and all the restaurants are open. So, is that everything, Jay?
Yeah. Thank you so much, guys, and have fun with the show.
Okay, no problem. Thanks very much,
Jay. Okay,
no problem at all.
Bye.
Okay, Marty, if you can come in with a question there, I'll get the next caller.
Excuse me.
Oh, you there, Marty? No, we've lost Marty there. Sorry about that, Andy. Look, it was another thing we discussed in emails, and I suppose we could go over it. So in the religion-science conflict, is there actually a conflict as you see it?
Well, see, in my mind, that depends on the religion in question and what they say. So I think at some base philosophical level, there's not necessarily a contradiction between a spiritual approach to life, you know, some kind of pantheist feeling, you know, a mystical approach to life, you know, as opposed to a skeptical one. And some people find themselves in science pushed well away from that, and some feel themselves encouraged by it. But that's quite different from the traditions of organized religion, you know, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, you know, which traditionally have made quite specific claims about the way the natural world works. And then, historically, they very much do come into a conflict. And as we know, so in Europe, you know, that's was, you know, what you know, the problems with Galileo and Copernicus and all that famously was all about. Now, these days, and I think that's distinct. So these are most of the problems of religion, I think, are kind of social and political, and about, you know, I have some mystical instincts, but basically, as far as organized religion is concerned, my tendency is to see them as kind of slave systems, basically. And that's still with us. But it's not much to do now, most of the time, with conflicting directly with science. But the exception, of course, is in the US and creationism.
Yeah.
And that's just very depressing and scary how that could pop up like that. It clearly is possible, even for well-organized religions, to reach a state where you don't have to do that. You reach a sort of accommodation with science. So now, even when Galileo was having his problems, a lot of the people at that time, not the people in the church at the time, were perfectly happy what he was discovering, and always looking for ways to accommodate it within the Catholic worldview, etc. Likewise, in one of the classic eras of development of Arabic science, this is less well known, but in 8th, 9th century Baghdad, when there were huge advances made in all kinds of science, there's an argument I've seen made that was because the official philosophical position that went with Islam at the time under that caliphate was that something, I think it's known as Mu'tazilism, but it's the idea that there's a book of God and a book of nature, and anybody's responsibility is to understand both. And so basically, you know, whether you feel that this is natural or just a kind of force fit to avoid argument, you can develop a philosophical position.
Yeah.
That allows you to have your cake and eat it. Okay. Right. So you don't have to have a conflict between science and religion, but in practice, it does keep coming back.
Right. I suppose I have to ask this because you know he's brought it to the media. What's your general opinion of how Dawkins is approaching the science-religion conflict?
So when he started that, I thought it was a bit too confrontational. And as I said just now, my instinct is always to kind of try and avoid that, to keep it to the positive, to assume religion's going to happen, you've got to deal with it.
Yeah.
When I first picked up Dawkins' book, I was expecting to get really irritated by it because I thought it would be philosophically naive and, too confrontational. And it was very confrontational, but it was in fact very, very good and incredibly clear.
Yeah.
And so he taught me something actually which I found interesting. And that philosophically, my position, philosophically, strictly speaking, I wouldn't describe myself as an atheist. Okay. Because I think the only rigorous position is one of agnosticism.
Yeah.
Okay. I went through a little questionnaire that he has in the middle of his book. Do you do this? Do you believe this? And I found I was what I think he called a de facto atheist or something like that.
That was a six on his scale or something. Was it a five or a six? Or it's a 1 to 7 scale he had.
Yes, exactly. That's the one. Yes. So I still do have mixed feelings about whether he's whether it's helping or not. I was a big fan of Christopher Hitchens and his approach to all this.
Okay.
Before he went, which was a shame. So some days I think Richard Dawkins is wonderful, and some days I just wish he'd shut up.
I find it strange that you would like Hitchens over Dawkins, because in my view, Hitchens was more confrontational than Dawkins was. I think that's just how different people view things.
Well, it is, but you see, I think it's interesting that I've spoken to a number of practicing Christians and so on, and they all get cross about Dawkins, but quite often they don't get cross about Hitchens, even though he was very rude and confrontational. Yeah. And because the way he said all that, it was clear that although he didn't agree, he understood what they felt and where they were coming from.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of his life, that makes sense because he was religious early in his life as a child.
Yeah.
And then shed it, but because of that he understood it. So I don't know, that's just something I've heard some religious people say, that they're not so upset by Hitchens because he understood, even though he disagreed with them.
All right. Marty, are you back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I had a slight emergency I had to deal with. I'm here now.
All right. If
I could weigh in on this particular issue, I think when it comes to being confrontational, it depends on what it is you're being confrontational about. Because I never get confrontational when people basically just, okay, they believe in God. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I disagree, but I realize that it shouldn't really bother me. So it's not my place to try to change their mind. But when people start misrepresenting science, for example, then I'll be confrontational.
Yes. That's fairly close to my position. As ever, you kind of try and judge personality of people who are doing this before trying to work out how to react.
Yeah. So
I think that roughly describes my stance. But I know plenty of people who are not just Dawkins, but friends and colleagues who will be much more confrontational, who see it as their duty to seek out people of religious views and pick holes in them and try and mentally retrain them, as it were.
Yeah.
And so there certainly are people who think that's the right thing to do. And it's clear to me from Twitter discussions and blogs and all sorts of things that this feels very different to colleagues in the US to where it does here, let alone being in Afghanistan or Iran or whatever. In the US, it feels quite different to the way it does in the UK or other European countries. People just feel much more threatened by religious fundamentalism, and specifically to do with science and education and so on.
Okay. Any further questions, Marty?
No, not right now.
Okay. Well, I suppose one that I had, I'm struggling to remember, I've been trying to keep a mental note of everything, is just astronomy in general. Like I said, a lot of people have the attitudes, like I've come across, you know, it's all just pretty pictures and it does nothing for us. How do you respond to that when you get that kind of, you know, cynicism about astronomy?
You mean does nothing for us in a practical sense?
Yeah, it's like, I remember very specifically one day, it was my last job, and I was speaking at work, and I think we'd just been watching, do you know the History Channel's Universe series? I think myself and
I'm aware of it, but I haven't really seen it.
Yeah, and I think it was, they were talking about the photons from the, you know, the center of the sun takes so many thousand years to get through. And then this guy at my work says, what the hell is the point of all that information? Like, we should only be studying things that actually help people here. You know, this is all just, you know, big waste of money, just pretty pictures and nice sounding documentaries, and it doesn't do anyone any good. So, well, have you ever kind of come across that, and like, what's your reaction to
it? Yes, yeah. Certainly so. Well, I'll take that in two parts. One is that one shouldn't sneer too much at the pretty pictures and the nice documentaries, because there is a cultural importance to astronomy and an entertainment importance, and those things are not trivial because many, many people love them. Just to put it crudely, a large fraction of the population just disagree with your colleague there, and they want to see the pretty pictures.
Yeah.
Okay, now, but that's not the real answer. That, you know, that is important, but the real answer, it's about time scale. So really, for me, astronomy is just a branch of physics. So it's about understanding how stars work, how galaxies work, solving those physical problems. And historically, astronomical problems have been quite important. So that makes it sound like applied physics, and you don't have to apply the physics to the cosmos. But all applications of physics advance physics and our understanding of the way the natural world works in general. And historically, astronomy has been had some incredibly important examples of this. An example not so many people are aware of is that we talk about general relativity. So you might, in terms of physics, you might think of, you know, general relativity as one of the most useless areas of astronomy, of physics. It obviously was deeply connected with astronomy and its origins and testing. We only knew it was true by measuring deflection of starlight and eclipse, as Eddington did in 1919, and of measuring deviations in the orbits of neutron stars. So the astronomy, the facts of astronomy were very important to understand how gravity actually really does work. And then you might say, well, at this point, that's fine. It's very interesting, but that only affects astronomy. So you wouldn't. So if it wasn't for astronomy, you wouldn't have general relativity, and who'd care? But right now, today, every day driving our cars, we rely on GPS. GPS would not work without our knowledge of general relativity. You're receiving signals from spacecraft, and you have to understand their orbits and the timing of those orbits with extreme precision. And you have to understand the positions of the satellites and their motions with such accuracy that regular Newtonian gravity doesn't do it. You'd get it wrong. You have to do the correct general relativistic version of dynamics to do GPS. If we didn't, it's a tiny number. Something like I think it's something like 7 nanoseconds out typically. But in terms of locating yourself on the Earth, it would mean several kilometers. So every day now we all use it, and that, you know, would never have happened without astronomy. So there are many other examples. Nuclear power, we would never have understood really how atomic physics and nuclear physics work properly without the challenge of understanding how the stars burn. So all these things, and of course, you know, understanding even Newtonian gravity, and Newton was obsessed with the motion of the moon and of comets, and that's what pushed the development of Newtonian physics. And a large fraction of our society is based on, and how it works, and our engineering is based on Newtonian physics, all intimately tied up with things that might have seemed useless at the time. And then finally, jump the other classic argument, of course. Now, this is not to do with astronomy, but it's the general thing of useless things. You never know what's useless and what isn't, actually. So, electricity is the classic example. Mm. So, you know, when people were first doing electrical experiments, they were pure kind of interest and fun. There was no application. But now that's utterly transformed the world. And Faraday's famous for when somebody asked him, what use are these electrical experiments? He said, what use is a newborn baby? And he was exactly correct. Right? So when you're pursuing science, it's a slow process. So you never know. So typically, bits of pure science take much longer to affect the world. But when they do, the effect is enormous. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of a long speech, but that's my answer, that it can actually be completely transformative.
Okay. Marty, did you have anything there?
No. I guess I could go back to this thing you said about general relativity, about space not expanding, because that's something that I felt like, okay, I want to hear more about this, but I guess it would be too technical for most people. It would probably be too technical for me even. But I'm really interested in it. So are there any blogs or anything like that you could point me to? Or is it all in the peer-reviewed literature?
A bit of both. If you find an interesting discussion, let's say I was actually yesterday, really, I was commenting on somebody else's blog, and there's some links and some very interesting comments on this blog. So this is a blog by Peter Coles, who's an astronomer at the University of Sussex. He's an astronomer at the University of Sussex, and he has a very popular blog called In the Dark. And he also has a Twitter account. He's called Telescoper. Just yesterday, there was a posting on his blog linking to a popular physics video, which got this wrong. Minute Physics, which generally speaking is very, very good, actually. I think that you could be forgiven for getting it wrong, because, as I said, lots of professional astronomers do. But that's the place to follow that up. There's a very nice but pretty technical article by a colleague of mine at the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh called John Peacock. Other people around the world, Ned Wright at UCLA has written about this. A number of people have written this. So John Peacock's technical article was called "A Diatribe Against Expanding Space," which was quite nice. But yeah, you could, if people are interested, you could try looking for Peter Coles's blog, In the Dark.
Okay.
What was his name? Peter Cole.
Coles, C-O-L-E-S.
Okay. I suppose I had a quick question there. It's going back to the start. One of your research specialities was the online observatory. Can you give us a rundown of that and explain what that's all about?
Historically, the situation has been that more and more astronomy is online, and astronomy has always been pretty advanced in this sense that I think something like the third or fourth website ever was at the European Southern Observatory. As of a few years ago, more and more astronomy data was online and accessible through a variety of applications and web pages. But it was becoming chaos, a sort of Tower of Babel, because everybody put their data online, did it a slightly different way, and so you had to learn lots of different systems, and you couldn't mix the data very easily from two different surveys. That's a kind of Tower of Babel. So there was an initiative started in about the year 2000 and really started taking off much more quickly in the last few years. It's called the Virtual Observatory. There's a bunch of us who meet a couple of times a year somewhere nice and have lots of online working groups. Basically, we try to design a set of standards for the data format, for how you set up services that can serve images or data sets. effects. And so it's pretty dry technical stuff, but it's all about, as I say, it's making everything the same screw thread, as it were, so that you can have, you know, one application that can grab data from six different websites, and when you bring them together, you know how to do it, and you know that when you bring things together, they'll speak to each other, and you can plot one data set on top of another, and so on. So that's what that's about. It's a very technical, standards-based thing. It's about making the screw threads all the same for all the astronomy data over the world. So it's called the Virtual Observatory because the idea is that, once this is working as well as we can make it, then when you sit down at your computer screen and go and grab different data, it will feel as if it's all there in a single virtual observatory, rather than lots of separate places. So it'll be a kind of joined up world. So that's been kind of fun because I'm not a software engineer myself, you know, but like most scientists, I'm moderately geeky, and it's been really great working with good information technology people and serious software engineers, which we've had to do to make all this work. And we're kind of partway there. It's not a job that's finished yet, but it's good. So that's what that is.
Okay, we've just got 3 minutes left in the show right now, and it's just come to my attention that the 12th Doctor is Peter Capaldi, for those interested. So I don't know if you've got an opinion on that, Andy. That'll be.
I'm happy with that. I just wish it was still David Tennant, really, but. either that or I am old enough to remember William Hartnell, and as far as I'm concerned, the best Doctor ever was Tom Baker, but David Tennant was pretty close.
Okay, let's see, that's up to 2 minutes. So although you've been talking a lot, Andy, if there's anything you want to publicise, to shout out, or a wee bit of a soapbox moment, promote anything you want, you have the floor.
I think, no, nothing specific like that. I think I said this in the middle of the show, but and if I have a message for everybody, it's get out there and look at the sky. It's all very well reading abstruse things about, you know, time and space and black holes, whatever, which is great fun, but get out there, look at the sky, see the Milky Way, see a shooting star, borrow a small telescope or a pair of binoculars and find Saturn. When you do, it's just amazing. So I think that's what I'd like to plug. Yeah. Get out there and look.
I suppose one quick question to end on there, like for a total beginner, what's a good pair of binoculars to buy?
More or less anything. But of a reasonable quality. You want for binoculars, you want a wide field, and ideally you want them to have big lenses, so that you have more light gathering power. But almost anything will do, and you'll have fun.
Okay, we've got 1 minute left, and I think myself and Marty, a very big thank you to Andy for coming along. It's been fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
It's been a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, if I'm right in believing, is this your first podcast as well?
No, nothing quite as long before, but I've been a few times on something called The Naked Scientists, which is rather splendid.
Oh, well, we hope you enjoyed it as well. We hope everyone in the chat room enjoyed it. Like I'd say, just to remind everyone, the show will be uploaded within the next 48 hours. I said, if you've got any feedback, just email us in. And like I say, we are on the hunt for new co-panelists. So please email us in if you think you've got what it takes to interview all these interesting people. And big thank you for my co-hosts. And like I said, again, a very big thank you to Professor Andy Lawrence. He's got you do have a blog which people can check you out at.
Yes, it's called The E-Astronomer.
Yep, so look up just Google that and you'll find them. And thank you, everyone. I hope you all have a good night. And I hope, and I'm expecting a lot of geeky debate to be on my Facebook now with a new doctor. So, but good night, everyone. And we'll see you next week. And we'll hopefully have a guest arranged. Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Good night. Bye.